What?
This is side two of the tape of the interview with Lieutenant General Clark. Right you are, sir.
Yep. Damn sure this is
going. Yeah. Before we change the tape, I think this sounds very microphonic.
Yeah.
Before we, I think there's, feedback. If I slant it this way, maybe.
There we are.
Maybe the direction of the mic. Got it. We were talking about the, you were mentioning that some believe that the, there's really no need for the militia because their traditional role had vanished in that forces and being would fight the war. I'm sure you, well, I hope you'll agree, that while that was a possibility, in my view, it would have been unwise, in any event, to say we will not have a militia. Because war is a very serious business, and if we had embarked on a war in Europe, if we had been drawn into one, and if nuclear weapons were not used on a wide scale, then the event might arise that it would become a war of attrition to an extent the last ones were. They weren't all finished. They started as blitzkrieg, but they went on for 4 and 5 years, So that for the amount of money it cost, to me, the premium of keeping militia trained in case the thing wasn't a war, if a war started, that it didn't. I'm not expressing, well, if a war started and it didn't finish in 5 months or 6 months, you might have to draw on these people, and you had a nucleus of basically trained people. This made a lot of sense, and I feel they could do both. You can't become an expert, a real expert, in the weaponry today, in the militia. You have to have intensive training afterwards. We know that. Thank God we had about 3 or 4 years in England, because we were not well trained. So that I feel that the whole business of retaining the militia and giving them two roles was justified. One, on the priority task, if something happened, they could do a civil defense role, and should a war break out and carry on for a period, then you did have a nucleus of militia to build upon as before.
I think we're pretty well agreed on that one, Finn. Let's see now. Oh, there's occasional things that come up that are rather humorous. I have this card marked Ministerial Problems. And I just mentioned that one of the problems faced by the minister were the demands and the counter-demands with respect to military bands and how they... you'd get requests for them to play everywhere, all over the ruddy country. And then, countering that, you would get the Musicians' Union would protest that the servicemen's bands were harming them, that every time a service band was used, a union musician would not be used. And I have, too, that such complaints had been given a very great deal of consideration since every musician was also a voter. On the other hand, as one correspondent pointed out, there are very few bandsmen in Canada who made his living from playing in a band. But these requests came from all over the place. Festivals, reunions, centennials, holidays, everybody wanted a band. I was wondering if you remember any semi-humorous stories on that yourself.
Oh, well, I don't think they were really very humorous. We wanted, for example, we had a mass band concert in Toronto. It was started by Chris Volks before I went there as a GOC. And it was a very popular thing. We used it to bring to the people of Toronto at large, or metropolitan Toronto, the military. Yeah. And we massed all the militia bands in Central Command, and it was a very colorful concert. And tickets, of course, were free. And the stadium was completely filled. We had to give tickets, give them away. Otherwise, we'd be crushed at the gates. But we could have filled it oh, many times over, the Musicians Union refused to allow us to have this recorded for a record or for or over the television, and they won their point. So it was, we were using it, the bands, in many ways, as one part of a recruiting agency, one part of your public relations. And if you have a really good band, men nicely turned out in that, and if they play, it wasn't all military music by any means at all. Mm. And I think it did a lot for the military. But they were very strict about this. And indeed, a very large percentage of the bandsmen in the Canadian Army, and it may be so in the other service, I don't know, were Dutchmen.
Yeah.
Who came over, and they were very highly skilled musicians. And there were, of course, Canadians in it. Well, these people were musicians, and they were being paid for it. They were being paid for it. Well, so we had an employed musician, and he was probably competing as much as anything with people who were playing in bands as a sideline. It wasn't their main source of their living. I think you mentioned this yourself. Yeah. A lot of these bands are people who are musicians, but they work at some other job.
Yeah.
So it's not an easy one, is it?
Yeah. There's another another problem that he had, and I can imagine you would have heard reverberations of this one. And that is complaints from the unions regarding servicemen working after hours as plumbers, gardeners, handymen, taxi drivers, and heaven know else. And they made the complaint, of course, that the union men were taxpayers, that their taxes were supplementing a person who was taking away from their job, that that servicemen working after hours were contributing to unemployment of the civilians and whatnot. I imagine you remember that.
Well, yes, we had a great deal of this, and pressure, and people tried to bring pressure on to say these chaps couldn't do this. Moonlighting, I think, is the term they used. But after all, the serviceman is not highly paid. And today, we know that a great number of people moonlight, either in their own job. I know a painter who paints for a particular firm who said, well, if you want any smaller jobs done, I'm very happy to come work at night. Yeah. We know also, or we've heard, that when certain unions are on strike, that the people who are on strike will go up and take other jobs.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, that's all right, presumably, if they do it. But these other Canadians who just happen to be employed by the Department of National Defense, why should they be refused the right to do this so long as it doesn't interfere with their military duties? Mm-hmm. If one finds that a chap comes in, he's always tired or doesn't do this well, and he's moonlighting, well, he's got his choice. He'll have to go. But so long as he's doing his job properly, whether you can have two jobs or not is a national problem, and I don't believe that it should be focused on the military.
Mm-hmm. I think too that the one of the problems or the answer was that excuse me, that the government policy was, quote, there should be no interference with the private lives of individuals, and that the government therefore could not take action to impose restrictions on the activities of employees outside their normal working hours. In other words, if you can't lay down a law, you can't control everybody's after-hours work. And if you can't control it, you know, why have a law saying they can't do it? It would be foolish.
Very interesting. It would be very interesting to know whether the various labor unions complained about other public servants in Ottawa who might belong to civil service organizations who were moonlighting as well.
I've not seen that.
No, I don't.
Yeah, I've not
well,
seen
I don't
that.
Know. I don't know whether they do or
interesting.
Not.
Interesting. This is another card. Again, it's more or less miscellaneous on the request that perks would get, and indeed requests that come in for the damnedest things. People wanting to pick blueberries on artillery ranges, to go hunting within the limits of military camps, and to cut down Christmas trees on D&D property, to store, as was the case in 1958 in Vancouver at the RCF property there, the last and one of the oldest of the Vancouver tram cars, people wanting free flights on the RCF planes, people wanting to use DND vehicles and all that sort of thing.
Yes. The use of military camps was always a great problem, allowing people to shoot in or pick berries and so, especially artillery ranges. And I was certainly advised by the judge advocate that if they were let in, the area should be very well patrolled and restricted. Mm-hmm. Because if a person comes in, even though a waiver is signed and that person is killed or injured, the family has recourse in law to damages.
Good Lord, is that right?
So this is, and as you know, there are unexploded shells.
Yeah.
I don't say that the probability is not high that someone would be injured, but by God, the censoring you get, the headlines, invite berry pickers into a dangerous area.
Yeah, children pick up bomb on.
Pick up bomb,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or blueberry pickers stub toe on mortar
shell.
Well,
we had this. There was a great... some children got into the rocket range in Petawawa and picked up an unexploded... it wasn't a pit. It was one of the early bazookas we had. And I believe another boy was making one into a lamp for his mother, hammered it, and was killed. Well, this was, this shocked me. Elgin Armstrong, was deputy minister, and I went down, we looked over the ranges and whatnot, but one of them had bounced and skidded. Somebody had failed to count them all and didn't search enough, and this is skidded, a couple had skidded into the woods. Now, of course, there were signs all around, barbed wire, no one allowed, danger area, all the rest of it. But that, we didn't escape a tremendous punishment in the papers. And I believe there was some justification. As children are children, and that those rocket rounds should have been counted, and they should have gone searching with their minesweepers and whatnot until they found it. So this is a—I know it's an aside, but it shows you some of the real problems.
This again is a—is just an incident, but I hadn't realized that it took place during the Perthes regime, and this is the famous scare or incident about the false alarm given with respect to a rocket en route to Canada when December 60 was it? This was the NORAD thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it was a Canadian Slemon maybe in charge.
Roy Slemon?
Yeah.
Roy was the deputy commander at NORAD for a number of years. Yeah. He was at that time.
Yeah, no, it was October 1960, that's right.
Well, he was there at that time, because he was certainly at NORAD all the time I was CGS, yeah. And afterwards.
Can you remember any...
No, I don't remember that one.
Yeah.
I don't remember that one.
Well, I'll skip that one. Nuclear submarines. I don't know if you want to make any comments on nuclear submarines. There's something rather interesting here, though. This is an article from the Toronto Globe and Mail, July 61, that during a recent exercise in the Atlantic... The Royal Canadian Navy is reported to have discovered that it cannot provide defense against the latest type of submarines with conventional weapons. The United States nuclear subs are fast enough not only to outrun Canadian destroyers, but also to outdistance acoustic torpedoes launched against them by Canadian aircraft. And then it goes on, you know, since... this is a case that it was typical of the muddle and waste that are common through the Canadian defense program. It goes on to say air defense is in no better shape than sea defense. We have Bomark anti-aircraft missiles, which are useless against attacking missiles. But they weren't supposed to be used, as I remember correctly.
That is correct.
Well, I mean, they weren't supposed to be.
No, they weren't designed to do this.
Yeah.
They weren't designed to do this. They were bought with that knowledge.
Yeah. And only partially effective without nuclear warheads against bombers. We are acquiring voodoo interceptor planes without nuclear weapons, which they were designed to carry. The simple fact is that there can be no rhyme or reason in Canadian defense policy until the Dominion government makes up its mind whether or not to accept nuclear weapons from the U.S. And it goes on to say that we are wasting the greater part of our $1.6 billion annual defense budget.
Well, I think it's very easy to criticize this. I agree that it would be very nice if the government had come flat out and
clear terms stated a policy on nuclear warheads.
Mm.
But it isn't as bad as this writer is suggesting. If you get the voodoo, it would not be that difficult. They're trained to fly it. It would not be that difficult to have the necessary fastenings in that to put an atomic rather than a conventional type of weapon on it.
Mm.
Undoubtedly, the Americans had their own reserves of these planes, which could be, have been loaned or given to us while the others were being modified. So, in light of the fact, as far as I know, that the nuclear weapons remained under the control of the American government and thus its forces, they could be made available to us in the event of an emergency. And this arrangement, as I understand it, was made.
Yeah.
So,
this comes up time and time again, and it surprises me, I must admit, how blind some of these commentators are. They seem to think that the border between Canada and the United States has a huge mile-high wall running along it, that the two countries operate in a complete vacuum, that there's no agreement or understanding or, shall we say, quiet talks that go on, and this I just cannot see myself. Now, on the other hand, they may be considering the fact that if you start getting missiles zooming back and forth, there's bloody well not going to be time. This also is a factor. In other words, if you have, shall we say, Bomark bases X number of 100 miles from the nearest location of an atomic bomb dump, shall we say, our train's going to be running and all this sort
may
of
not
thing.
Be.
Yeah, they quite easily may not. Probably wouldn't be. God knows.
In the case of the nuclear submarine, I'm quite sure that the Navy would rather have had a nuclear-powered submarine than a conventionally-powered submarine. But same way as perhaps I should like a Rolls Royce. I can't afford it.
Yeah.
The military, the government, felt that it could not justify the expenditures that would be required to re-equip a nuclear submarine. They're fantastically expensive.
Yes.
But if you have a well-trained submarine crew, I don't think the conversion period would be that long. So that was the criticism was one leveled at the government rather than the military, and all I can say for the government is that each government must make its decision as to how much money could justify, and it honestly felt it couldn't justify the expenditures involved.
There's another counter-argument used, too, somewhere or other, saying that at that time, at least the Russians still had 400 conventional submarines. In other words, although they were beginning to build them.
They were beginning to build. They
still had most of the
other. But they didn't have. The Americans were ahead in the building of these. And so what we were doing really was comparing ours with the very best few the Russians had. And not quite a fair judgment.
Here, again, is more or less a miscellaneous bit. I just have to myself saying that on more than one occasion, Perks had received letters from some of the food industries, such as the Sour Cherry Growers Association or the Butter Producers Association, requesting that these particular products be bought in increasing amounts by the Armed Forces of Canada in order to reduce the surplus on hand in Canada. I'm just wondering if you ever came across anything like that.
Indeed, I did.
Did you?
Indeed. The question arose once. Many arose, but I think the one that caused us the greatest amount of bother was what they called canned ham, which was Spam. And you can't fool a soldier about this. And we had large quantities. I think we gave it away in aid to people to put more of this on the ration. Well, we had a very good ration scale, and you can't skew this badly without having adverse effect to morale.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know if you remember the Spam, when we went over to Normandy, we each of us had a 7-day ration pack.
Mm.
And
the Spam was good, I liked it.
Well, I liked the first tin. And I very quickly traded off my Spam. I had mostly Spam, some had salmon, some had bully beef. I traded off all my Spam, except one tin, for bully beef, at about two tins of bully beef to one of Spam. within about 2 or 3 weeks, the exchange rate was about 4 tins of Spam to get one of bully beef or one of salmon.
Oh, yeah.
It was very fatty.
Yeah.
And after a while, when you face this in the morning, I could face a biscuit and salmon or a biscuit and bully beef, but greasy Spam, no. Yeah. It wasn't popular. And there is always pressure to do this, but I think the government has been extremely fair in not putting undue pressure on or agreeing with the military that this should not be a dumping ground for surplus farm or dairy products.
I got that impression too from going through the papers.
You had to give good reasons in your replies to minister why you didn't want to, and if they were good reasons, I think I don't remember not being backed on this.
Yeah.
Milk contracts were, that's a separate subject, really.
Lulu's.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
Very, very difficult.
Yeah. Perks, when I was writing or doing research on Perks a couple of years ago, I came across one or two RMC people. More especially, what's his name, George Stanley, mm-hmm. who was at that time Dean of Arts.
Yes, I know George.
And he had no particular liking for Perks. He thought that Perks hadn't somehow or other done right by RMC. And I mentioned to Perks, I didn't mention Stanley's name, of course, but I said that, you know, I'd talked to several people who were at RMC. And who had this feeling, and he was rather hurt about it, I think. I just wonder if you might have any comments on that.
Yes. I was involved, naturally, in anything to do with the buildings at RMC. Not with academic programs, when I was Quartermaster General for 4 years, and of course, again, when I was CGS.
Hmm.
And I did not detect any difference in the treatment that was given to RMC or any of the services colleges. When I was QMG, that was Brooke Claxton, or when George Perks, Harkness, were ministers. I think that the services colleges got as fair treatment as it was possible to give.
Mm.
And if there was any unfairness, which I doubt, I think you could blame the military as much as you could the minister. Mm-hmm. Because you asked for so much money, so many barrack buildings, so many training areas, you had a building program.
Yeah.
Right? The RMC and initially, the Collège Royal de Saint-Jean were army problems financially. Then the Air Force took over the financial responsibility for CMR. We had the financial responsibility, we in the Army for RMC, and the Navy for Royal Roads. And you had to fit the priorities for your budget, your expenditures in construction and so, into your overall program. And having taught at RMC, and Red Sawyer being an old teacher, I loved the place and the people and knew the commandants. I think we treated it fairly. I don't remember anything that we put up that the minister, Mr. Perks, said, no, you can't have it for RMC any more than for any other reason. So I would not, I would definitely not support this. Again, staff and wages and so forth.
Oh,
this is all argued by the Adjutant General, but argued at one level, but they all came through the Chiefs of Staff. And I think the effort was made to treat these people as fairly and pay them from the pay point of view, the staff point of view, as fairly as one could run any establishment of this sort. So, in my view, George had a clean bill of health.
Yeah.
Any criticism of that sort.
On this one, dealing with radar. I think I have to grab Mary there for a minute. I think I'll let you read through it while I'm out, and then I'll question you on it.
You know how to shut. I don't want to play with this.
Right, we're on.
I remember this.
This is about the radars.
Yes, I remember a discussion of this. Proposal. But clearly, it was a very expensive operation. Involved a minimum of about 8,600 men, and according to that letter, a cost per year of 176 million, with a capital injection of 217 million, and then two fighter squadrons at 51 million. And it doesn't say whether that's per year or if that's the capital cost. It hasn't given the in addition annual burden of it.
Yeah.
So this would have represented a very large percentage of the total defense expenditures, which, if I remember correctly, you have it in your book, it's about 1.5 billion. Am I right?
Yeah, 1.6.
Went up to 1.6 about 1960. If that was 60, it was about 1.6 billion. So, if you add on something like 200 million annual, and probably a lot more, so you had 1,500 million total. And estimates are usually low. You had an annual one of roughly a seventh, 200 million to 15. You had a capital of 217 and 51, which is 268 million, with whatever annual additional cost. And first thing one would say, is this or is this not the best way in which to spend the Canadian tax dollar? Let's assume that in one way or another you had justified. Sorry. Well, if you spread their capital costs over, say, a period of 3 years and put in what is claimed for the annual cost, you're running about 18% of the total defense budget for 3 years, and thereafter about 15%. So if you had frozen at this, then you would have to have made a cut of that much in the other services. And since the Air Force, since the Army per person is a much smaller, cost less per person, in other words, if you were to divide the number of the Air Force budget by the number of people, and the cost per person is higher than it is in the Army, naturally, because the planes are very expensive. So you had to make very drastic cuts, either in the Navy or in the Navy or Army or both. And the what was the object of it? What I wasn't sure was some people wanted this, some Canadians did. I don't know what the American attitude was. I can imagine the Air Force would like it, because that would have they would have had to expand tremendously. Maybe they'd like that. Mm-hmm. But from a government point of view, I think the only question that could have arisen there would be sovereignty.
This seems...
I mean, if you're spending so much money and you freeze it at $1.6 billion, how do you best expend it? And that's a very hard thing to measure. I mean, there are not guidelines for measuring it. Public opinion is... if you're spending so much, public opinion is a great factor in this. Well, then you have to say, well, if we were to take all this over and say, we now do not have American stations in our country, does this improve your appearance as a spender of the defense dollar? I don't know. I can't see any military reason myself. No. If they are doing it, to have this screen of radars, the type they had at that time, they were more useful the further away they could get them, because they got greater warning. And if you had the distant early warning line, and if a conventional bomber was coming along, this gave American fighters, Canadian fighters, and everything got time to meet them well up in the unoccupied territories. Now, that was the object. Now, what does it matter who did it? The Americans did it. They felt the need. They had the money. Well, then, the question was, should we do it? I don't think any arguments that I would make here would be particularly useful. I would have doubted this myself.
Yeah, this of course was one of those emotional
emotional fogs or clouds that enshrouded that entire era. And it still exists today.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Incidentally, that's the last card, by the way, so we can dash over and grab it.
Yeah, sovereignty is...
But this sovereignty bit, God help my soul, you see it.
Wow.
You see it in these books that I have on my desk. This one here. Partner to Behemoth, the military policy, the Satellite Canada.
You just
press the center one.